Thank you, Vajragupta. Isn't this great? Fantastic, isn't it? So many of us here. Actually, Vajragupta has got something to do with this talk, in that my original idea for the talk was to talk partly about the Buddha's voice. Maybe the last 5 or 10 minutes of the talk I'll talk about the Buddha's voice. But the first part of the talk, the main part, was going to be how the Buddha spoke to people. I was looking at different suttas, and he said very different things for very different people. He used very different methods of communication. So the talk was going to be about that, with a little bit at the end about the voice. But then the advert came out for the retreat, and it was all about the voice of the Buddha. So I thought, well, I better give a talk about just the voice of the Buddha. And actually, I'm very grateful for that, because it really made me focus on one tiny topic, and in a way quite a difficult topic to talk about, because we haven't got the slightest idea what the Buddha sounded like, have we? Not the slightest idea. So here goes. We know, don't we, that for the first few hundred years of its history, Buddhism was an oral tradition. His teachings were only written down 200 or 300 or 400 years later. And we know this partly from its own internal evidence, the Pali Canon's own internal evidence. For instance, you get this triad of the three wisdoms, the three levels of wisdom. The first level is wisdom through hearing, sutta, S-U-T-A, wisdom through listening, through hearing. Second level is wisdom through reflecting, and the third level is wisdom through meditating. So wisdom through hearing, not wisdom through reading. And then there's a very interesting sutta where Sariputta, one of the Buddha's two chief disciples who was enlightened, is speaking to another monk, and he says to him, "Friend, there are two conditions for the arising of right view." The Pali is samadhiti, which can be right view. It can also mean perfect vision, insight. "Friend, there are two conditions for the arising of right view or insight: the voice of another and wise attention. Those are the two conditions for the arising of right view or perfect vision: the voice of another and wise attention." So you can hear my voice, and I just hope you're giving it wise attention. Buddhism was an oral tradition because India at that time was an oral society, mainly an oral society. I've been trying to find out if it was a completely oral society. I seem to remember many years ago, maybe decades ago, reading or hearing that the Brahmins, or at least some of the Brahmins, did read. They had texts that they recited and studied. But I'm not too sure about that, so don't quote me on it. But we can be pretty sure that nearly everyone was oral. That is to say, they didn't read or write. I say oral rather than illiterate, because if we say illiterate, that we're defining them in our terms, in terms of what they're not. They can't read or write. But they're an oral tradition. Everything communicated was spoken and heard. The scholar Walter J. Ong, sure you know him, makes the point that it's very hard, perhaps even impossible, for us literate people to really imagine what it's like to be in an oral society. We tend to think of it as being like our society, except they don't read or write. But reading and writing changes the structure of consciousness. So let's try to imagine what it must have been like to live in the Buddha's day in an oral society. And I'm indebted to Walter J. Ong's books, Orality and Literacy, and The Presence of the Word, for the next part of my talk. So, in an oral society, words are only spoken. Sounded, heard. They're oral. in a literal society, words are also written, therefore read, seen with the eye. When an oral society becomes a literate society, there's a shift in the importance of senses from the ear to the eye, from the oral to the visual. Spoken words are events. They happen in time, usually between people. Written words are more like records. There they are, on the page. By the way, in an oral society, it would be the height of incompetence for a speaker to have notes in front of them. There they are, on the page, or the papyrus, or the tree bark, or whatever. There they are, to be referred to, and to be referred back to if necessary. What did so-and-so say or write? I'll go back and have a look. We can do that. In an oral society, there's no going back to have a look at words that were spoken. And of course, oral societies usually do not have recording equipment. So you can't go back. Therefore, in an oral society, memory is highly important. That's why Ananda is such an important figure in early Buddhism. He had a tremendously good memory. He could remember everything the Buddha said. That's why at the beginning of all suttas, nearly all of the early discourses of the Buddha, they begin with the words Evamme Suttang, which means, thus have I heard, or I heard this. And what this means is Ananda is repeating back what he's heard. So, in an oral society, when somebody said something, you'd better remember it, and you'd better hear it right. Think of Bahia, of the bark garment, who walked right across India to see and hear the Buddha. And at last, after weeks, perhaps even months of walking, he finds the Buddha. Unfortunately, he's come at the wrong time, because the Buddha is begging for alms in a village, and it's his custom not to speak when he's begging for alms. Bahia doesn't know that, of course. So when he sees the Buddha, he approaches and he says, please, Buddha, give me a teaching. And the Buddha explains that he can't right now. Now is not the right time, Bahia. But Bahia is not to be put off. He's walked right across India to hear the Buddha. So he says, no, time is short. We could die at any time. Please give me a teaching. But again, the Buddha resists and he says, no, now is not the right time. But Bahia just insists again, please give me a teaching. Life is short. We don't know when we're going to die. So the Buddha relents and he teaches those now famous lines, probably the most quoted of the Buddha's teachings in our community, the Tri Ratna community. Thus must you train yourself, Bahia, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, in the sensed, only the sensed, in the cognized, only the cognized. And it's important that Bahia hears this correctly. He can't say, wait a minute now, let's just get this going. Put it on your robe, put this in your pocket. He can't do that. So what if he heard it wrong? What if he heard, in the scene only the bean? In the herd only the bird? What then? Would he have gained enlightenment? Because he did. He gained enlightenment. Would he have gained enlightenment? Or would he have gone away scratching his head saying, that's something to reflect on, isn't it? In the scene, only the bean. In the herd, only the bird. What can it mean? What can it mean? But luckily, he didn't hear it wrong. He gained deep insight on hearing the Buddha's words. Incidentally, the Pali word for listen, sutta, S-U-T-A, is, according to the Pali English Dictionary, heard in a special sense. And then in inverted commas, received through inspiration or revelation. So what the Buddha said to Bahia was a revelation to him. A revelation mainly through sound, through the Buddha's voice. So we know, don't we, more or less, what the Buddha said to Bahia. But we don't know how he said it. That's one of the disadvantages of the written word, isn't it? No tone of voice indicated, no intonation, no pitch, no way of knowing the rhythm, the speed or slowness, the warmth, perhaps, in which the Buddha said it. How the Buddha said those words was probably as important to Bahia as the content, the conceptual content. So, did the Buddha perhaps catch Bahia's sense of urgency, his hurry, his haste? Did he therefore speak quickly? Thus must you train yourself, Bahia, in the scene, only the scene, in the herd, only the herd. Did he do that, I wonder? Or did he perhaps resist Bahia's haste? Did he speak very slowly, slowing him down? Thus must you train yourself, Bahia. In the scene, only the scene. In the herd, only the herd. Which words did he emphasize, I wonder? Did he emphasize only in the way that I just did? In the scene, only the scene? Or wasn't that really the important word? In the scene, only the scene. And it's interesting, isn't it, that when we have a sentence like that, the sentence doesn't make any sense until the last word of it. In the scene, only the... So there's Bahia waiting now, waiting for the punchline, the punch word. In the scene, only the bean? In the scene, only the scene. Did he gain insight at that moment? That very moment, in the scene, only the scene? Or was that a preparation for the second bit? In the herd, only the herd, etc., etc. Perhaps the Buddha responded with some humour. Perhaps he thought, what is the hurry? You know, just wait a minute. And so maybe he responded with humour. Okay, thus must you train yourself, Bahia. In the scene, only the scene. In the herd, only the herd. We've got no idea, have we? No idea how he said it. Another difference between the written word and the spoken word is that the written word is static. There it is on the page. And there it stays, unchanging, unless you burn the page or destroy it in some other way. And the spoken word is fleeting, very fleeting. As Walter Ong, as you can tell, Walter Ong is one of my heroes, as he writes, sound exists only when it is going out of existence. It's amazing, isn't it? It's as gone as soon as it's come. Take the word permanence. By the time you get to nunce, perma has gone. Just listen. Permanence. It just goes like that. Now, that permanence is quite a long word, isn't it? Three syllables. Let's just take a one-syllable word, dog. Dog. By the time you get to guh, duh has gone. Dog. It just goes immediately. Homer, not the... I mean the oral poet Homer. He often used the term winged words. Winged words. They just fly. But only a spoken word is winged, not a written word. But that's the nature of all sound, isn't it? You can't capture a sound in the same way that you can capture an image. There's no way to stop a sound and have it. You can't have your sound and listen to it. If you try to freeze a sound, it simply stops. Or if you were able to freeze a sound, it would become meaningless. And that's why in the Tibetan Wheel of Life, the Buddha in the God realm is depicted holding a lute, actually a veena, an Indian instrument, a bit like a lute, a veena, playing the music of impermanence. Now, what is that music? Well, it's any old music. There's no special impermanent music. All music is impermanent. One note comes and it's gone, and another note comes. Imagine if you thought, I like that note, just stay there. Well, you're not listening to music anymore, it's gone. Written words, by contrast, have a sense of permanence to them. They remain on the page long after you've read them. Records of something someone has said or written to be referred back to at any time. And when you look at a word, as I'm doing now, you see the whole thing from beginning to end in one unit. There's the word permanence. I can see it here. You can't see it, but I can tell you, I can just see it all in one. Permanence. Unlike spoken words. And because you can see the whole word and refer back to that word, it's easier to conceive of written words as things than it is to conceive of spoken words as things. Spoken words are more event-like than written words. And of course, words in an oral society are not made up of letters. They're not spelled out. Walter Ong makes the point that we literates, when we think about a word for more than a few seconds, we probably see it spelled out in our mind. Take the word nevertheless. Nevertheless. Can you resist seeing nevertheless? Now, an oral person would have no conception of that going on. It would stay as a sound. We kind of translate our sounds into letters, don't we? I said earlier that when a society becomes literate, there's a shift in emphasis and importance from sound to sight. So let's now consider some of the differences between the sense of sight and the sense of sound. Sight perceives surfaces. When we see an object, we're seeing light reflected from the surface of that object. We can't see beyond or behind those surfaces. We can't see inside the box, for instance. That's why, incidentally, Sukhavati, the Pure Land, is flat. Something that hill walkers don't like. When hill walkers come across the Pure Land, they go, oh, I don't want to be born there. There's no hills to walk up. Why is it flat? Well, there's a very good reason why it's flat. Because when there's a hill, you can't see on the other side of it. You can just see the hill. So in a flat land, you can see all around you. So Sukhavati is a place, a mind state, in which you can see everything unobstructed. But sight doesn't let us do that, whereas sound, on the other hand, reveals interiors. You can't see beyond the surface of that box, so you don't know if there's anything in there, do you? Now you know. There is something in there. What is it? Ah. And here's a bell. So let's ring the bell. Hold on a minute. Someone put sand in it, and you couldn't see that sand. Sound reveals interiors. Similarly, the human voice reveals the interiority of the speaker. The voice is expressed. Express means to press or squeeze out. So the voice comes from inside us to the outside. How does the voice work, actually? How do we make vocal sounds? How do we speak? Well, the voice is audible air. Normally, when we exhale, the air is silent, because the vocal folds, as they're technically called, we call them cords, the vocal cords, are pulled open like a pair of curtains, apparently. When we speak, though, they close, and they close together and they vibrate, and that creates sound. The lungs, trachea, larynx, pharynx, nose, jaw, mouth, soft palate, hard palate, teeth, tongue, lips are all involved in speech, as is 3/4 of the torso. We speak with our body. But there's another sense in which voice is the expression of our interior. When we speak, when we cry, when we laugh, when we moan, when we scream, we're expressing our interiority towards others. We are making ourselves manifest. And the hearer perceives the interiority of the speaker. So the voice connects interiors. It communicates our inner life, our thoughts and feelings to others. The voice is inherently communicative. The voice brings about community. The voice brings about sangha, friendship. That's why in our movement, the Tree Ratna community, we're talking a lot. We talk a lot, don't we, in our movement? It's because we're so keen on friendship and community. We're constantly, while we're talking, we're constantly revealing our interior to others, whether we know it or not. Words are usually spoken to others. There are listeners. And it's interesting that the Buddha's immediate disciples were called savakas, hearers. So the spoken word is largely a social act, a social event. The written word is more solitary. To write a book, the writer has to lock him or herself away for a few weeks or months, in some cases years. And the reader too usually reads in silence on their own. If you've done any teaching, you'll know what it's like when you give out a handout. Yeah, before the end of the class, you give everyone a handout and suddenly they're reading. And suddenly no one's in communication anymore. Everyone's gone into their own world. Emotions are expressed through the voice. According to some research, a depressed person tends to speak with a low pitch. So does someone who is bored. Contempt is loud and slow. Anger has a high pitch and is fast. Stress is high, loud and fast, but so is confidence. Grief is low and full of pauses. Surprise glides. And scorn has an even descending melody. But it's not easy to accurately tell someone's emotional state through the sound of their voice, because people differ in how they express their emotions. Still, we can usually tell with someone we know well, can't we? I'm sure you've been in the situation where someone you know well has phoned you up and you happen to be in a low mood. And as soon as you say hello, they say, "What's wrong?" Or if they ask you how you are and you say, "Okay," they say, "No, you're not." Especially when it's your girlfriend. The Buddha, as we know, was enlightened, which means that he would not have experienced depression, boredom, contempt, anger, stress, grief, or scorn. His interior life would have been full of goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, and happiness. So we have to imagine a voice that expresses those emotions: warm, confident, happy, but deep, steady, firm. But can wisdom, can enlightenment be expressed through the voice? We know the conceptual content of wisdom can be expressed through the voice, but it's largely the words that do that. In the seen, only the seen. It wouldn't have worked for Bahia if he'd have heard, in the seen, only the been. I mean, can wisdom be expressed in the sound of the voice? In its expression, in its tone, its intonation, its rhythm, its pitch, its volume, etc. And I'm going to try to answer this question in a roundabout way. I wonder if you're one of those people who like the sound of their own voice. I don't mean that you like it when you're actually speaking, but when you hear it back, played back from a recording. Because it's different, isn't it? This is partly because when we hear our voice directly, when we're actually speaking, we don't hear it through the air, as others hear it, but conducted through the bones of our skull and the distorting vibrations caused by the Eustachian tube. But what about when you hear a recording of your voice played back to you, say on your answer machine? It's one of the hazards of modern life, isn't it? Making little messages for your mobile phone. Hello, this is Ratnaguna. Please leave a message. And then you have to hear it back to make sure it's... You think, oh, that doesn't sound like me. Surely that's not me. Must be really bad recording equipment. And sometimes it is the fault of the recording equipment. Even some of the newer digital answer machines make our voice sound thinner, less resonant than it actually is. But this may not be the whole story. There is a theory, a psychological theory, why we don't like to hear the sound of our voice played back. And here's the theory, and I'm quoting here from a paper. It's because we hear the unsuccessful or incomplete editing of aspects of ourselves that we didn't consciously intend to express, but which we now hear in the recording. In other words, we hear in our voice our unacknowledged self, our repressed, our conflicted self, our shadow perhaps. We hear that and we recall from it. That's not me. I don't really sound like that. But when you talk to someone, you say, that doesn't sound like me, and they say, yeah, it does. It's just like you. So what you're hearing now as I'm speaking, you're hearing the whole of me through my voice. I can't hear it, but you can hear it. You can hear my repressions, my conflicts. And I'm sure there are some very, very sensitive psychotherapists out there who could probably come up and say, you know, you've got a bit of a problem with such and such. So if this is the case, think about how a voice of a person with no unacknowledged aspects, no repressions, no conflicts might sound. A person completely free, free of all constraints, released. A person released would have a voice released. As I said earlier, we've got no idea what the Buddha really sounded like. But I don't think that means we can't imagine what he might have sounded like. After all, we've got pictures of the Buddha and statues of the Buddha. And we reflect on them, we meditate on them, we contemplate them. And we've got absolutely no idea what the Buddha looked like either. So why not? In fact, if we were to hear the actual real voice of the Buddha, we may not like it. Because what is considered attractive in one culture is considered not at all attractive in another. His voice may have been too high in pitch for our taste, or too sing-song, or too fast, or too loud. So, perhaps it's just as well we don't know what the Buddha's voice sounded like, because that leaves us free to imagine. How would you like him to sound? I say we have no idea what he sounded like, but there is at least one reference in the Pali Canon to his voice. It comes in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 91, the Brahmayu Sutta, and this is about an aged Brahmin called Brahmayu, who had heard of the Buddha, and he wanted to know whether he was as great as the reports he'd heard of him. So he asked his young student, Uttara, to go to meet the Buddha to find out. So Uttara goes to meet him, and he decides to stay with the Buddha and follow him and observe his behaviour. And the text tells us he followed the Buddha for 7 months, like a shadow, never leaving him. And at the end of that 7 months, he returned to his teacher, Brahmayu, and he reported back. And the next few pages of that text are a very thorough description of the Buddha. And this is what Uttara said about his voice. The speech that issues from his mouth has 8 qualities. It is distinct, intelligible, melodious, audible, ringing, euphonious, deep, and sonorous. However, interesting as this is, it doesn't really get us very far, does it? Now, I think we have to start from scratch, really. So let's do that now. Let's try to imagine the voice of the Buddha. Or should I say the voices of the Buddha? Because like everyone else, like you and I, he would have spoken differently at different times. He was once a young man, vigorous. He was later an old man, a sick man, a dying man. Surely he would have spoken differently at those times. Sometimes he spoke to just one person, sitting face to face. At other times he spoke to many people at the same time, almost giving a public talk. Sometimes he was gentle, encouraging. Other times he was wrathful, reprimanding. So let's try to imagine how he spoke in different situations. Just after his enlightenment, the just released voice. The first sutta of the Udana. He was very recently enlightened. The text tells us that for 7 days he'd experienced the bliss of enlightenment, and at the end of that 7 days he uttered an Udana. Udana literally means an exhalation, a breathing out, an inspired utterance. Here's what he said. When things become manifest to the ardent meditating Brahmin, all his doubts then vanish, since he understands each thing along with its cause. A simple teaching. Who was he talking to? Who on earth was he talking to? There was no one there but him. He was talking to himself, perhaps, or perhaps to the universe. What he'd understood inwardly, perhaps he had to express outwardly to really understand it. So how did he say this? Did he say these verses quietly, reflectively, perhaps with a sense of wonder? When things become manifest to the ardent, meditating Brahmin, all his doubts vanish, since he understands each thing along with its cause. Maybe he was still understanding it, still understanding it more deeply to himself as he said it. Or did he say them loudly, victoriously, for the whole universe to hear? Was it his lion's roar? When things become manifest to the ardent, meditating Brahmin, all his doubts then vanish, since he understands each thing along with its cause. We don't know how he said it. Later, in his teaching career, as we call it, there's the story of Angulimala, isn't there? Angulimala, the serial murderer, who had Angulimala means garland of fingers, and every one of his victims, he cut one of their fingers off and put it on his garland, and he had 99, and he wanted to make it to 100. He was walking through the forest looking for someone to kill, and the Buddha knew this, so he went walking in the forest so that Angulimala could find him, and Angulimala sees him in the distance. So he starts walking after the Buddha, stalking him, and the Buddha just walks away, not fast, just at his normal pace, walks away. And Angulimala can't catch him, so he breaks out into a trot, still getting no closer, even though the Buddha's walking really slowly. The Buddha carries on just walking mindfully. Eventually, Angulimala's running, trying to catch the Buddha, and he can't catch him. And he stops out of breath, and he says, "Stop, recluse, stop." Basically, the Buddha's done his head in. He's just walking along, and Angulimala's running. He can't catch him. So he's completely confused. "Stop, recluse, stop." And the Buddha just turns and says, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Amazing, isn't it? How did he say that? Did he say it fiercely, meeting Angulimala's violent intent? "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Maybe he did. Or maybe he said it really quietly, reflecting his own inner life, ahimsa, non-violence. "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." Maybe it was full of compassion for him. "I have stopped, Angulimala. You stop too." And it did stop him. "While you are walking, monk, you tell me you have stopped. But now when I have stopped, you say I have not stopped. I ask of you, my monk, what is the meaning of it? How is it that you've stopped and I have not?" "Angulimala, I have stopped forever. Forswearing violence to every living thing. But you have no restraint towards anything. So that is why I have stopped and you have not." How did he say that? Did he say it like I did? Probably not, because he's enlightened and I'm not. Something happened, didn't it, between them. And then Angulimala is completely overcome, overturned. He throws all these weapons in a pit. And he says, "Oh, at long last, a sage I can revere." And the Buddha says, "Ehi Bhikkhave. Come, monk." He ordains him. Those two words, how did he say them? "Ehi Bhikkhave. Ehi Bhikkhave. Come, monk. Come, monk." Interpreters, I'm going to skip the next story. Kissa Gotami, we're going to move on to the reprimanding voice. Here's a nice story. The Buddha's somewhere out in the forest, and Sariputta and Moggallana, his two chief disciples, bring to the Buddha 500 people, men they've ordained, 500 new bhikkhus. They've come to see the Buddha. And while they're exchanging greetings with the resident bhikkhus, preparing their resting places, putting away their bowls and outer robes, putting up their tents, they were very loud and noisy. And the Buddha said to Ananda, "Ananda, who are these loud and noisy people? You'd think they were fishermen hawking fish." How did the Buddha say that? Yeah. "Ananda, who are these loud and noisy people?" Was he annoyed? "You'd think they were fishermen hawking fish." Was he frustrated? What did he sound like? What was going on for him there? So the Buddha asks Ananda to go and tell them to come and see him. So they come over, they pay homage to the Buddha. And he says to them, now there were 500 of them, more than is here at the moment, right? So he's speaking to 500 people now. So he must have had a loud voice. Must see. I've got microphones here. Let's go down here. Monks, can you hear that? Monks. Bhikkhus. It's much easier now, isn't it? But the Buddha didn't have that, so he must have been able to really speak, mustn't he? Bhikkhus, why are you so loud and noisy? One would think you were fishermen hawking fish. These new Buddhists, newly ordained, they've travelled a long way probably, they've come to see the Buddha, in fact they're all excited. And the first thing he says to them, Bhikkhus, why are you so loud and noisy? One would think you were fishermen hawking fish. Go, Bhikkhus, I dismiss you, you cannot live with me. Imagine that. Imagine if you were on the bus from Essen. 18 hours, you get here at midnight, and then you're making a noise, and Vajragupta goes up and says, go. I dismiss you. You cannot live with us. Well, that's the situation, isn't it? Yes, venerable sir, they replied. And they collected their things and they left. What about an intimate voice? A playful voice. Once the Buddha was completely on his own, wandering on his own. You don't often get that in the suttas, the Buddha completely alone, wandering. Had to stay the night somewhere, goes to a village. There's a potter's shed. He goes to the potter, he asks him if he can stay there. This is lovely, actually. He says, if it is not inconvenient for you, Bhagava, I will stay one night in your shed. Imagine the Buddha saying that. You know, so courteous. Well, of course, you know, he wouldn't say, can I stay in your shed? If it's not inconvenient for you, Bhagava, I will stay one night in your shed. It's really good to imagine him saying that, isn't it? It is not inconvenient for me, sir. It is not inconvenient, but there is a homeless one already in there. So if he agrees, then you can stay as long as you like. So the Buddha knocked on the door opened, and it was a bhikkhu called Pukkhasati. And the Buddha asks him, if it is not inconvenient for you, Bhikkhu, I will stay one night in this shed. And Pukkhasati says, the shed is large enough, friend. You can stay as long as you like. And they sit there and they meditate all through the night together. And in the early hours of the morning, the Buddha asks him, under whom have you gone forth, Bhikkhu? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you profess? And Pukkhasati says, friend, there is the recluse, Gotama, the son of the Shakyans, who went forth from the Shakyan clan, accomplished, fully enlightened. I have gone forth under that blessed one. That blessed one is my teacher. I profess the Dharma of that blessed one. So the Buddha says, but Bhikkhu, where is that blessed one, accomplished, fully enlightened, now living? Isn't that lovely? Pukkhasati doesn't know it's the Buddha. And the Buddha knows he doesn't know. And instead of saying, well, I'm the Buddha, he says, well, where is he now? So he's having some fun. He's having some fun with Pukkhasati. Where is that blessed one? Accomplished, full enlightened, now living. You can almost hear the humour in his voice. There is, friend, a city in the northern country named Sarvati. The blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, is now living there. But Bhikkhu, have you ever seen the Blessed One before? Would you recognise him if you saw him? How did he say that, I wonder? No, friend, I've never seen that Blessed One before, nor would I recognise him if I saw him. And you know, the Buddha never tells him. Never tells him. But he teaches him, and at the end of that teaching, Pukkhasati realises his mistake. You are the Buddha. And the Buddha says, yep, I'm the Buddha. Fantastic. Okay. What about the Buddha towards the end of his life? He's aged. He's sick. His dying voice. The Buddha's final days as recorded in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. The Buddha says to Ananda, as for me, Ananda, I am now a broken down old man. Aged, far gone in years, I've reached the journey's end. I'm come to life's limit. My age is now 80 years. Just as Ananda, a worn-out cart is kept going by being tied together with helps, even so, Ananda, my body is kept going by helps. Surely his age, his decrepitude, would have been expressed in his voice. It would have been an old voice, wouldn't it? Perhaps weary, cracked, husky. As for me, Ananda, I'm now a broken-down old man. Aged, far gone in years, I've reached the journey's end. It wouldn't have been a young, vigorous sound, would it? And what about his last words, the words he spoke just before he died? You know them, you've heard them before. Now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. With mindfulness, strive. Usually when we hear them a bit like that, don't we? Sort of declaimed. Now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. With mindfulness, strive. He wouldn't have said it like that, would he? He was just about to die. A few minutes later, he died. He was on his way out. He probably spoke with a great deal of difficulty, getting the words out somehow despite his physical condition. Probably very quietly, probably very hard for his hearers to really make out what he was saying. Maybe they had to really strain to make out the words. Now, monks, I declare to you all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. With mindfulness, strive. The voice of a dying man, struggling to speak, to express himself, to squeeze out from his interior the final thing he wanted to say. In 1931 and 1932, someone called Alexander Luria, I bet you're wondering how that's spelt now, aren't you? Alexander Luria interviewed lots and lots of illiterate and somewhat literate people in the remoter areas of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan in the Soviet Union. One of the things he discovered was that an oral person, what we might call an illiterate person, doesn't think in abstractions, doesn't think in abstract terms. When an oral person was shown geometrical figures such as a circle or a square, they always identified them as concrete things that they were familiar with in their actual life. So when shown a circle, for instance, they said it was a plate or a sieve, a bucket, a watch, or a moon. A square was a mirror, a door, a house, an apricot drying board. Whereas the people who'd learned to read and write, even a little bit, they identified them as circles and squares. So the point Walter Ong, to come back to him, makes is that words tend to structure knowledge, written words tend to structure words and knowledge at a distance. At a distance from what Ong calls the human life world, the world that we actually live in. Whereas words and thought in an oral culture stay very close to our human life world. And I want to end this talk with a quote from a text called the Mahavastu. It's not a Pali text, this one. It's not from the Theravada tradition. It's from another early Indian tradition, the Lokottaravadins, the Lokottaravada. Like the Pali text, it's a written recession of what was an oral tradition. Lokottara means above the world. Or to use more abstract terms, transcendent or supramundane. And the Lokottaravadins believe that the Buddha's appearance in the world was just that, an appearance. In reality, He lived above the world, or you could say beyond the world. He wasn't of this world. So I'm going to read you a part of the text that enumerates 60 qualities of the Buddha's voice. And it describes the Buddha's voice mainly in terms of sounds that people in India at that time would have heard in their ordinary daily lives, their human life world. So his voice is said to be like, for instance, a thundercloud, the rattle of chariot wheels, the cry of a water bird. Of course, the Buddha's voice didn't literally sound like those things. Did you notice what I just said there? Literally. Yeah? Didn't literally sound like. Should have said orally, shouldn't I? Didn't orally, didn't really sound like those things. It would be really weird, wouldn't it? Bizarre if someone sounded like a thundercloud, or like the booming of an ocean, or like the merry tinkling of bells. Imagine the Buddha coming on sounding like the merry tinkling of bells. But we don't need to take it literally. As we know, there are visual descriptions of the Buddha that show his skin to be golden, red, white, blue, yellow, green, sitting in the sky on a lotus cloud, rays of light of all colours radiating out from his body. We're happy with that, aren't we? These are descriptions of the Lokottara Buddha, the supramundane Buddha, or as the later Mahayana has it, the Buddha of the Sambhogakaya, the body of enjoyment, or the subtle body of limitless form. Here we see the Buddha not in his Nirmanakaya form, not in his flesh and blood, physical human body, but his mind-heart, his interior being. You could even say his reality. Similarly, this text doesn't tell us what the Buddha's voice literally sounded like. The author or authors of this text take all of the most beautiful, lovely, attractive, ordinary, extraordinary, awe-inspiring and plain frightening sounds that they know, and they say the Buddha's voice sounded like them. It's interesting, isn't it, that the Lokottara Buddha, the Buddha above the world, is described in terms of all the familiar things of the world. No time to go into that now. That's a fascinating area, isn't it? That's for another talk. So we're now going to hear the effect his voice, the Buddha's voice, had on his disciples, or at least on the author or authors of this particular text. We're going to hear the sound of the Lokottara Buddha, the Sambhogakaya Buddha, what he sounded like to his inspired visionary disciples. This is what the Buddha's voice sounds like to the uplifted imagination. All Buddhas are endowed with a voice of perfect qualities. It has 60 qualities. What are the 60? The voice of the excellent man pervades everywhere with a sweet musical sound. The Sugata's voice is like the sound of the lute and the fife. It is like a swan's song. The voice of the eminently wise one is like the roar of the thundercloud, yet sweet like the cuckoo's call. It is like the rattle of chariot wheels, like the booming of the ocean, like the cry of a water bird, like the notes of the kinara, the sparrow, and the cloudbird is the voice of them who bear the marks of excellence. It is like the trumpeting of an elephant and like the roar of the king of beasts. The utterance of the preeminent of men and devas is deep as the sound of drums. It is like the rustling of the wind-swept forest, like the rumbling of an earthquake. The voice of the conquerors pervades everywhere, like the sound of an orchestra of the five instruments. It is low, like the gentle note of the duck, of the red-lipped, slender-tongued peacock. The voice of those who are preeminent in virtue is sweet as the song of the Gandharvas. It is like the sound of the lapping of waves, and it is not rendered confused by distance. The voice of the foremost of men, both in heaven and on earth, is like the merry tinkling of bells, yet full. It is like the rustling of a net of gold and like the jingling of jewels. The voice of those who bear the marks of excellence is not too hurried, nor uneven, nor faltering, but sweet, gushing, and coherent. The sweet voice of the Dasabalas pervades the whole assembly. It makes the whole assembly understand, even though Nayutas of worlds are gathered there. Though it speak in one language, his utterance becomes current everywhere, even in the barbaric assemblies of the Scythians, the Greeks, the Chinese, the Ramatars, the Persians, and the Daradars. The voice of the most eminent of men as it goes forth does not miss anyone in the assembly. The voice of the Dasabalas is neither raised nor lowered, but remains even-toned. The Sugata's voice is not broken, nor forced, nor affected, nor halting. It sounds like a hymn of praise. It is not vulgar nor corrupted, but consists of wholly ordered sounds. It thrills all men, good and bad, with its accents. When the speaking voice goes forth from between the spotless teeth of the virtuous one, flocks of birds in the sky and wood rejoice. When the eloquent Sugata's voice goes forth in the assembly, it is adequate to the need of any tone that may be desirable. The clear voice of these sweet-toned men issues melodiously and earnestly. It is like the sound of a mountain stream, like the osprey's cry. It is like that of the blue jay, like that of the pheasant, which is coloured like the golden leaf of the palm tree. Its stirring sound is like the noise of the crashing drum on the tabor. The voice of those who have attained perfection is to be recognised and acknowledged as deep and terrifying, yet good to hear, and always reaching the heart. The voice of all the meritorious ones who have gathered a rich store of goodness, whose glory is unending, is pleasant to the ear like an Indian lute. Such is the true description of the Buddha's voice.
Such a good speaker, isn't he?